But what I wanted to start with, actually, because we have not been having class for the last 2 weeks, the last class topic was, as people can guess, I believe the topic was, are we having fun yet? And the whole discussion was on fun and what people thought was fun. And as I listened to the class, I thought actually the fun could be categorized into three areas. People, do you remember from the class? And you would like to chime in, please feel free. We have a small group, but basically, I think one thing that was interesting to know was it was really different for every single person in the room. For us, actually, we have quite a shared definition of fun, which is probably why we're all together. Because I think the other thing that happens is the people who have the same definition of fun end up hanging out together.
Everyone else had a normal definition of fun.
Yeah, we're a little bit
Whereas,
more studying the Dharma is fun
yeah,
and
our
studying the
definition
sutra
today
is
is a
fun,
bit,
skewed.
yeah.
But
We're the Dharma nerds.
we're the Dharma
Dharma
nerds,
nerds,
yeah.
yeah.
So basically, though, I thought there was three areas that were brought up last week. And I think still it's valuable to think about because at least for actually how Dharma comes to this modern world and to particularly the younger generation, I think if you put it this way, I will say this is probably one of the things where we lose a lot of young people in the Dharma because their experience with the Dharma is very not fun. It's like the opposite of fun. And it's growing up, and that's why a lot of times after day Sunday school in the temple, that's the last place you're probably going to go is the temple because they think it's not fun. So I think for maybe those who are working with kids or who have kids, the thinking about how Dharma can be fun is actually a really valuable exercise to make the Dharma connect with the modern generation. And for myself, because if it's not fun, it can get kind of lifeless. So I thought there was three areas.
The Dharma may not exactly be categorized as fun, but how we learn the Dharma can be fun.
Yes. Well, I think the thing is, this is just a note, is that it's different societies have different value, different cultures have different values. Ultimately, I mean, we don't want to be limited by our cultural narrative. But here in the West, in America at least, for a young person, fun is actually a very important value for what you're doing. Whereas I would say for a traditional Chinese person, from a traditional culture, fun is actually not a value. In fact, fun is almost a negative value, I find. That there's almost a sense of,
Frivolity to it.
there's a little bit of frivolousness to it. There's a little bit like when you're cultivating, you're supposed to be enduring suffering.
Oh, you
You're
mean from the
supposed,
point of
for a
cultivation?
point of cultivation, I would say for a lot of the Chinese,
Oh, okay.
that's why I say for the traditional, why is there just such a big break a lot in our communities from the more traditional Asian community and the younger kids that you're trying to raise is because how they're approaching the Dharma is quite different. For a young person, if the Dharma is not fun, then when it becomes on their own choice, they won't choose it because for them it's not fun. They're only going to choose something that's fun. But for an Asian traditional Asian person, it's like their duty or there's a responsibility or they're just enduring suffering because in the future such and such will happen or they see a bigger something or another that they subscribe to. So just they're a little bit different. So I think it's an important topic for bringing Dharma to the modern mind.
Yeah, but what
Can I just,
yeah.
there's a couple of people online who want to
Responded?
chime in.
Oh,
Yeah.
great. Yeah.
Okay, good.
Okay, so Liz Wong says, it's fun to listen to the Dharma talks at
Ah.
BBM via webcast since I'm not in California.
Oh, well,
Yay.
happy
So,
Liz.
let's see. And Tom Brosher said, fun is taking time to observe nature and our environment to see it as it is and the interaction of all things.
That's a good one.
Yeah. And Jason Kong from Portland
Oh, hey,
joined
Jason.
us.
Great.
Hi, Jason.
Well, Jason, if you can come up with something that you think is fun, you can type it in the raise hand section.
Yeah, what's your definition of fun?
Yeah, what do you find fun?
I
Oh,
just
yeah, go
want
ahead.
to, yeah, I just want to add that there's a difference between suffering and hardship. You can undergo hardship and you don't have to suffer. Whereas
Yeah.
the so I think it's not to say that say a modern person cannot endure hardship
Yeah.
because you know, hardship is physical, you know, hardship is the conditions that you are in, but suffering is in the mind. So I think when Ram Master said to endure suffering, you have to, I don't think necessarily that the translation meant you feel really bad as you're undergoing hardship. It's just that you just have to endure hardship. If it comes, don't be afraid of hardship. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you are suffering in the mind, that you're being tormented. You can actually be very, very blissful while still undergoing hardship.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I can think one example is that I find a lot of Chinese people really inspires them is that quote from Mencius. I know Fan Bao Shi often quotes it to me. He says, like, before heaven bestows a worthy, great task on a person, he has them endure bitter turmoil, suffering in his mind. Bitter hardship, but actually in the mind, like mental anguish.
Oh.
Like bone-wrenching like toil, poverty, hunger, failure in all their undertakings. And then when their character is forged and their kind of spirit is honed, then they have their outstanding abilities that's beyond an ordinary person. But what you see is that with that way of seeing the world, they really can cultivate. And for instance, the cultivation isn't suffering in the sense of that we would take it, because they see it as a growing process. So that's why it's a different whole. If you have that framework, it becomes very different.
Yeah, they have understanding behind it.
Yeah, there's a framework where it's like, I'm doing this because there's a greater purpose behind it. But for most young people, they don't quite see that. So what I wanted to go is review a little bit about what, yes, last 2 or 3 weeks ago, people mentioned what was fun. So I thought it could be categorized in three areas. One was fun that was exciting or sometimes a little dangerous. I believe Steve was the one who said it. And he basically said, you know, doing some kind of dangerous, extreme thing that was completely engaging.
So someone else also said, that's not fun.
Someone else said, that's fun. But actually, that's true. I think a lot of people go to, say, extreme sports as a way to get kind of like a rush. And it's actually really, really engaging. Right? So that's one area. I'm sure we've actually, before we probably started the Dharma, we all had some experiences of that. I don't know if people went bungee jumping or parachuting or rock climbing.
Another comment?
You have another comment? Is that Jason?
I'm not sure.
Jason
we
is
lost...
bungee.
Okay, no, so
jumping is his fun.
Fun for me is giving, helping others, especially helping others to be relieved of stress they may be going through, helping them feel a sense of relief by speaking through a situation, etc.
Who is that?
Does it say? That's a technical difficulty. When they refresh, we lose their names.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Anonymous.
Sorry. Anonymous.
Okay, so that's one. Actually, that points to the second one, which people have mentioned, which is relieving stress. Is basically where I think that oftentimes people feel really stressed out by what's going on. Let's say they have a lot of work to do. I know in school, it was in college, oftentimes the idea was you just work really hard throughout the week and then you unwind on the weekend and you party, you know, kind of in a way that you can basically relieve all that stress that you've accumulated throughout the week. And that's the time you give yourself a break. And you're like, oh, okay, I can relieve my stress. That comes through like what, video games, parties, movies, all the various entertainments that we have. I mean, so I think that's another real way people think that's fun, right? So that's another one. And the last one that people mentioned was just hanging out with friends. Jason just said that. And I think that's particularly fun because people are completely open, and with friends, you often don't feel like you have to be putting on a show for them, that you're relaxed. If it's a kind of a social, high social pressure situation, then it's not exactly fun. It's kind of like, and with a group of friends, it's like, then it becomes not fun. But if it's just friends you know for a long time and just people accept each other really well, then, you know, that's, I think for a lot of people, that's fun, at least for a younger generation. So I think that's what was went over last week. People actually generally shared those three categories, right? The thing that I thought was interesting was when we'd mentioned, I didn't mention anything, I was in the class, but I was actually at CityDB. So what I heard was basically the fun of the world oftentimes creates more habituation. That's what happens in the world. I mean, we go for fun in the world. Oftentimes what happens is we create more habituation that ties us up more in in a particular habit or particular way of doing things, and it limits our mind, our conscious awareness. It makes us less free, as Doug would put it. And while Dharma joy is actually freeing us from habituation. So the more we study the Dharma and find happiness and fun in the Dharma, or we take Dharma as our fun, in fact, we get freer and freer. And actually, what's nice about it is that the fun just gets better. As you get freer, you get more and more spontaneous, more and more free, and things become more and more fun. You get less and less bored and less dependent on things. So that's, you say, markers of Dharma fun is it gets you freer. Well, anyway, so the other kind of fun is a backwards fun. Again, it gets you more and more tied up. Oh, I think that's okay. So that's one. That's one of the things I thought was a really important, you could say, observation, that when we're studying the Dharma, we want it to be fun. It's going to basically help us get free. And so, so what I thought would be valuable to go over tonight was actually, oh, we have people calling in. Is that a caller in from afar? So what we're going to go over is Nagarjuna on the six perfections as we do each of the week. Oh, yeah.
Because you raised the issue of like how fun is important, like in teaching Dharma,
For the modern young generation,
yes.
not for older generation
right,
so
right,
much.
Right. Well, yeah. So, how do you see that? Do you have any ideas how to implement that?
How to implement
that? Like, potentially a very strong idea, but what do you do with it?
What do we do with it? He says, how do you make Dharma fun for younger generations?
Oh, okay. You answer first.
Okay. Well, I think first. Okay, first, you actually have to be having fun. Uh-huh. That's number one. So if they watch you and they don't see that you're actually having fun studying the Dharma, then I think for most young people, because they mostly look at the person, what they're actually doing, and they evaluate, then they go, that person is not doing what I'm doing or what I want to do, so then they don't want to follow it. What else would make it fun? So maybe you can throw an idea. I have to think about it. I didn't really prepare about that. But.
Okay, having a community, like what Jinchuan said, if someone comes or you have a group of people come and they see a community that's practicing the Dharma and they're having a lot of fun doing it, so they can feel the effects of the Dharma. Like Jinchuan said, you know, if you're speaking about Dharma, you're not having fun, and you say the Dharma is fun, no one's going to say, no, I can't see it from you, that's fine. The second thing is, I guess, making it, especially for young people, making them see how it can be helpful for them. Mm-hmm. So say like, if you talk about, you're talking about very, very young, or like teenage young, or young adult young, what young?
The question I was raising was more like, Jinchuan Shi kind of mentioned it, well, in teaching Dharma, in
the
modern
world, if they're really young, you can employ like,
Puppets,
you know, music. Game for the really young. You make it engaging. You make the learning process fun. So it sticks in your mind. That's really important. Even for adults, you have to make it fun, because if it's not fun, people lose interest. It can be in a form of discussion. But the most powerful one is to first you speak in the language they can understand, and then in a way that they can see the effects for themselves, either through examples or through stories or through ways of that they can quickly see or reflect upon their own experiences and seeing that it works. So like say for giving. And if you talk about giving to grow young people, they say, you know, whenever you receive a present, if it's your birthday, how do you feel? So if you want to make friends with someone and you give someone something, do you think they'll like you? You know, so if they can see that it really helps them in their everyday lives, and you give them a new perspective on, and it helps if you, the person who's delivering it is doing it, you know, in a more engaging manner. It doesn't need to be fun, as long as it's engaging.
It's a good question. I think we can reflect on that more if you want to go into that deeper, because I think it's a valuable topic. But maybe first I go over some of the things, because I think this might answer a question slightly, although not directly, was I actually thought dhyana meditation, although some people probably think that's the last thing they would think is fun, is actually has a lot of the qualities that we just described as the three major categories of fun when done with a kind of energy behind it. So for instance, why do I say that? Well, the first one was when you're doing something that's really engaging, quote-unquote often dangerous, but in meditation, ideally, you're not doing something too dangerous. I guess investing in your mind could be dangerous if you don't know what's in there.
Yeah.
But you're actually coming up with, if you're doing completely engaged, single-minded focus, you're completely engaged. You're absorbed by it. You're working hard on it. Right?
It's not boring.
Not boring. The other one says you're relieving stress. You're free of stress. Well, ideally in meditation, your afflictions are not arising. Or if they're arising, you're observing it, so they're not taking over the mind. So it's also, I mean, that's why a lot of people see meditation as kind of a stress reducer. So you're reducing stress.
As Doug would say, if you are really concentrating, you can't be thinking about stress or being depressed or being unhappy.
Yeah. And the last one I thought was actually that third one, which was the group of friends, you're completely relaxed and open and in kind of the space. Actually, also in meditation, you're actually completely relaxed and open as well, ideally. You're not trying to get into a military stiffness. You're actually really relaxed in your heart and your mind. So actually, dhyana meditation has all those elements of fun that we look for, but it just turns it a little bit, which I think actually the Buddha does a lot. If you look at the early teachings, when he came and taught, he taught, like, for instance, he says the Brahmins, you know, have a caste system, and the Brahmins were, you know, born into the caste of Brahmins, which are the highest. He said, well, no, the true Brahmin is one who's, you know, mastered his mind and ended suffering, you know, but is completely liberated. He said, that's a true Brahmin, not from birth, in a human, I mean, like you're born, but in a noble birth, right? And so he took the words of that time and turned it around into something else. So for our modern time, maybe the word is fun. Mm-hmm. We can turn it around to say, oh, this is fun. Meditation's fun. Okay, not going and playing video games all day long is fun. Actually, if you spend that time meditating with the same amount of vigor you'd go and play video games with, and I played a lot of video games when I was a kid, that you would actually find yourself much freer. And so what I thought was valuable is if we went over to Nagarjuna's text, Nagarjuna Bodhisattva's text on dhyana meditation, because he actually goes into great detail about what meditation and what dhyana is. And so I printed out a couple pages from this text, which is Nagarjuna on Six Perfections. And we're on page, I believe, chapter 28. So just as a quick recap, so basically Nagarjuna Bodhisattva is making a commentary on the Sutra of the Perfection of Wisdom, and he basically, the text is actually very short, and then he goes into a lot of depth explaining each principle. And so this one is particularly on the perfection of dhyana meditation, the paramita of dhyana meditation. And actually, it's very appropriate because right now at Siddhidhanta Buddha's, we're doing a chan session here in Berkeley. We're sitting quite a bit as well. So
actually, we have one. Are you going to say why dhyana?
Why?
It is said that the bliss of dhyana far surpasses any kind of joy or fun or enjoyment that worldly pleasures has to give.
Mm.
That's why the Buddha encouraged people to be able to enter dhyana absorption, because the bliss of dhyana cannot be, there is nothing in the world that compares at all to the bliss of dhyana. It is so, yeah, it's like eating plain rice every day for the rest of your life, for your whole life, and then suddenly discovering that there are things like condiments and sauces and fried rice and, you know, pineapple fried rice and all kinds of different rice dishes. Yeah. So that's why the Buddha advocated people to explore dhyana absorptions. Because from there, then you can see how coarse or how rough and unrefined worldly pleasures can be, and how worldly pleasures actually, in as I think Chin Chuan Shu will explore in Nagarjuna's words, how worldly pleasures actually give rise to dissatisfaction and suffering. So yeah, so that's why we're speaking about dhyana meditation.
Yeah. So if we go to the first line of the text, it says, because first, actually, dhyana, people might not know, dhyana actually, when it got to China, it became chan. Actually, first the word was chana, and then they dropped, because Chinese dropped characters, right? So it became shortened to just chan, and that became zen in Japan, and then America, we mostly refer to as zen. So chan here, or dhyana meditation, is actually chan meditation or zen meditation, just to give some context, okay? So here, the first line, it says, the sutra text, so this is the Mahaprajnaparamita sutra text, it says, it is through being neither mentally distracted nor indulging of enjoyment that one should perfect dhyana paramita. So basically, the sutra explains what dhyana practice is. So we're not distracted, we're single-minded, we're completely absorbed in it, and we're not indulging in enjoyment. We're not indulging in particularly, like, say, sensory enjoyment. We're not even seeking after some kind of blissfulness. It's something that we cultivate, and you'll see in this particular time, is that in this particular text, that the way that this paramita is perfected is not then actually seeking after the bliss of dhyana. It's because the bodhisattva actually wishes to benefit all living beings. His cultivation is for that reason. And so he's able to go through all those states of bliss and not get attached to any of them, and not seek after any of them, but rather do it because he knows that this is really important, and it will go through in the text, in his quest to help living beings. So for instance, which we'll read, dhyana is the container whereby wisdom can actually be expressed. If you don't have any concentration, then even if you have wisdom, you can't actually use it, which he'll go explain. He'll explain in a little bit, in a number of analogies. So I think the first question is actually really good for meditation, because this is often what people say towards meditators.
What's the point?
The question we'll read, it says, well, the question in the heading goes, why does the bodhisattva meditator abandon beings? So the actual text says, the dharma of the bodhisattva...
Actually, they say a lot about that, about monks.
They say that about
people
monks.
People don't quite understand a monk's life. Oh, so you're going to be a monk and just go meditate and renounce the world.
Renounce the world, yeah. Forsake the... So the dharma of the bodhisattva takes the spiritual liberation of all beings as a work to be done. Why then does he sit at leisure in forests or marshes, or abide still and silent in the mountains, solely benefiting himself, casting aside and forsaking beings? That's basically a lot of people ask that question. Aren't you leaving the world and just meditating on your own, right?
I always ask that question.
I've heard that question many times.
Many times. So the Nagarjuna Bodhisattva's response is, although the Bodhisattva may be physically far apart from beings, still his mind never forsakes them. Residing in a quiet location, he strives to develop the meditative absorptions and thus obtain actual wisdom. This is in order to eventually deliver everyone to liberation. So I think that's really interesting, because he basically says that the bodhisattva meditator in his mind never forsakes living beings. In a way which is, you could actually go and meditate and forsake living beings.
You could.
But the bodhisattva doesn't. And that makes all the difference.
And because he also understands his own limitations. You go... The only reason you do that is so that you can come back more with the skills and with the abilities to help people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not for yourself.
Yeah, so the next one he says is, he makes an analogy. He says, it's like taking medicine to cure a malady. So this is analogous to when one takes medicine to tend to the body and then adds an expedient, sets aside household responsibilities. For instance, I guess, becoming a monastic. Or maybe going to a chan session. When one's energy and strength return to their normally healthful state, then one takes up one's work again just as before. The Bodhidharma's indulgence, quote-unquote, in stillness is just like this. He employs the power of dhyana absorption to ingest the medicine of wisdom and then gains the power of the super knowledges. He then returns to be among beings, becoming perhaps a father, mother, wife, or son, perhaps a master, student, or lineage elder, perhaps a god, perhaps a human, or on down even to becoming an animal. He employs all manner of speech and skillful means to instruct and lead. So basically, it's like you can meditate because you're basically taking medicine.
Does that need to be unpacked a little bit? Or,
yeah, okay.
I guess, you know, from a conventional sense, when we understand people to meditate, then what are the kind of abilities that they develop? Is that a good way of contextualizing it? Because I guess the analogy is that they kind of take medicine or they develop... Uh-oh, is this camera pointed towards me?
The spotlight's on you.
It was more of actually raising a question. But that's okay. If I was like, that's some people, we go, well, okay, so what is it about dhyana meditation that would be able to help this cultivator benefit people then? Or is that something that we'll talk about later? Or I guess I'm just kind of raising that as a question.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
I think it'll be.
It will be, but I think you can try to answer first and see what you can think of.
Yeah.
What would you think of?
Oh, you mean asking? Okay.
Oh, yeah, if you want to answer.
No, no, no.
Jason,
no.
Yeah, Jason, what do you think? What would you think that would be some of the things that...
Well, I think...
You put yourself on the spot.
I'm just going to say from just a very mundane sense, you know, it just helps me be more effective that I... it just sounds so very conventional, but I like conventional answers that are kind of rooted in my everyday experience, that you can ground yourself, that you're aware of what is going on with yourself, right? And that you're a very solid person and you're not selfish and needy. And from that, you can actually do a lot just from that itself.
Yep.
So.
And also, although this is speaking about bodhisattvas, the only difference between, I guess, normal people and bodhisattvas are the vows that we make. A bodhisattva has vows that to benefit all living beings. So they will never do anything, or they strive not to do anything selfish for themselves. So when they enter, or they want to enter dhyana, and they hold the precepts really well, it's all out of desire to help living beings. Can you just say your question again, so that I don't lose my train of thought?
I guess my question is, you know, since it's the analogy is that you're kind of taking medicine, so what is it about dhyana meditation that helps you help other beings?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of it
in later on, right?
Later on, yeah. Let me just make it an example, because you just talked about it this afternoon with us, because we were meeting about the university. Just recently, I'll say about 20-some students, college students, came to visit 6,000 Buddhas. They were doing service around the community, helping out. At least when Jason and Kin were recapping the experience, it sounded like one of the main things that the kids or the college students, when they came, experienced was basically being disconnected from all the social media. And that they were actually afraid to go back into the world of social media and all that entailed. And so if you look at quote-unquote dhyana, not entering dhyana in the ultimate sense, but say this thing of renouncing household responsibilities, renouncing a little bit of the worldly stuff, which would be, for instance, social media, you gain a certain amount of clarity and insight, which they all commented on, right? That's what you were telling me, that they commented, wow, I got so much clarity and insight by being this last week here that I can bring back into my life, but I'm worried about going back in that. So by being a little bit of still, you actually can tap into your own wisdom that you can then see something. So it's something really, I say, very direct experience you guys just described with these kids coming.
Well, Ken described it.
Ken described it.
They related that story to
it. Or just seeing how life affects you.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have to be anything in particular, just how everyday life has a hold on you or does not, and how your happiness is hung on certain things, dependent on certain things,
mm-hmm.
and being able to step back and just see that in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Because most people, things happen, they feel sad or they feel happy without quite knowing that their happiness is dependent on certain components of the chain of events.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. But also, maybe it's just to reflect on it, this is valuable in a way as an attitude towards meditation. Is this like taking medicine? So we take medicine to get better. We meditate, so we're kind of healing our mind, returning our wisdom or wisdom state.
Mm. Remember, Master yeah. says is there's food for our
dharma body.
Yeah, he says we eat food, you know, we exercise and we do all kinds of things for our physical body, but we actually do nothing for our dharma body. So meditation, cultivation, that's feeding the dharma body, and that's actually more important than the physical body.
Yeah.
Can I ask?
Okay.
To just represent people maybe online or in the future, why is that? What is the dharma body, I guess? And why nourishing that is good?
Okay, let's frame what's the dharma body.
Okay, well, let's expand the quote. Oftentimes it says, I think the dharma body, wisdom, life. So I can relate to wisdom much more easily. The dharma body is, I don't have any direct experience with this. So I can't actually say.
I have a metaphor.
Okay, you can use a
metaphor. Yeah, it's kind of like this. You can enjoy for today, but how are you preparing for tomorrow? So if you look at the way the Dharma teaches us about life, it's not just today, but there's always a tomorrow. There's a next year, there's a next month. There's even, if you extend it further, there's a next life. So do you want to just, how would I say, enjoy to the maximum today, live for today, and then see what happens tomorrow? Which means that if you get, say, a paycheck, do you want to blow it all in 1 week? And then for the remainder 3 weeks, then start to worry about what's going to happen, or actually have to undergo the what's going to happen. So basically, it's how do you want to be short-sighted or near-sighted? Yeah. And how far-sighted you are depends on your understanding of the Dharma. For some people, it can be what happens after I die. For some people, it can be what happens in the next few years of my life. And is my life perfectly fine now? Can I cope with stress? And, you know, am I totally in control of my emotions? So for some people, it's the immediate now, dealing with the emotions. For some people, it's dealing with the afterlife. Some people it's being able to help people around them either now or depending on the vows they make. Yeah.
Okay, so the other analogy that I think is really interesting is he uses a lantern. So he says a lantern becomes bright in a still room. So this is analogous to a burning lantern. So we don't really have too many burning lanterns now. We all have these flashlights and LED lights, but I think we still can imagine what a lantern is like. Although the lantern is capable of providing illumination, it cannot be useful in a stiff breeze. However, when one places it in a closed room, its usefulness then becomes completely manifest. Wisdom in the context of a scattered mind is just like this. Although one may possess wisdom, without the still room of dhyana absorption, its usefulness is incomplete. If one gains dhyana absorption, then genuine wisdom comes forth. Is it on this account that even though he is apart from beings and far away in a quiet place, the bodhisattva is nonetheless striving to gain dhyana absorption? It is by virtue of purity in dhyana absorption that his wisdom becomes pure as well. This is analogous to an oil lamp. Because it is clean, its brightness is also immaculate. Because of this, one who wishes to gain pure wisdom cultivates this dhyana absorption.
I think we can use batteries for a modern equivalent.
Okay.
For a flashlight, you must have fresh batteries.
Okay. So that one's I think a very clear analogy.
So meditation is charging your batteries.
I think this says that wisdom is the room, right?
Wisdom is the light.
Wisdom is the
dhyana,
the light.
Is the room, the still room.
So basically, dhyana is the room.
The
okay.
candle. Imagine a candle flame. Let me make it simple. Make it a candle. The candle is ringing. The candle is burning, and if there's a wind that's blowing on it, then it's hard to have any light, right? But if you can stop the wind, then the light from the candle shines brightly.
So the batteries are dhyana.
So in the analogy, basically the flame is the wisdom, and when it's in the scattered mind, which is blowing wind, then the light can't shine. But when you're in a still room, which is dhyana, the stillness, then it shines brightly.
Yeah.
So you're saying the batteries are dhyana?
Yeah.
And the flashlight is the wisdom.
When they're almost done, you have to recharge them.
Yeah, the scattered mind is your battery not charged. You use up too much of your energy running around for outside things, so you have no battery power.
Because now everyone's always, is my phone fully charged? Is my tablet charged?
You got to close more of your apps. It's using too much of your battery.
Yeah, too many apps at once. Too many computer apps.
I'll reserve the life of my battery. But dhyana is more important than that.
Actually, that's interesting. You can say chan is also kind of a charging. It recharges you, for sure. I think people have that experience. So you can use a battery. So then this talks about the necessity of mental focus. I won't read that one because that one's pretty straightforward. It basically says for even the worldly things, you need to work really hard. How much the more for transcendental things? So we need to work hard. And he gives a lot of similes. This is on the next page, on page 2. Similes for unfocused thought. So if you find any of these similes useful for your mind, then you can use that. So it says dhyana absorption refers to the focusing of thought which has become chaotic. Chaotic thoughts float lightly about even more readily than goose down. They gallop along and scatter ceaselessly, moving faster than a swift wind. Their uncontrollability and unstoppability are more extreme than that of monkeys. The suddenness of their momentary appearance and disappearance exceeds that of lightning bolts.
Wow,
they're pretty intense.
I know.
So the necessity of employing dhyana, the focused thought, it is the characteristic of thought to be unrestrictable and unstoppable like this. If one does not wish to bring it under control, then in the absence of dhyana, then one will be unable to achieve absorption. So if you're into video games, you got your thoughts. Each thought is like the boss master at the end of the game. You have to beat that level. If they're unrestricted, unstoppable, so you have to use dhyana to overcome that level.
Actually, the thing about what we just said, about the like thoughts being like monkeys and our minds being, you know, it's very hard for someone who's never practiced meditation or who has never had a moment of stillness to see why that's a problem.
Which one?
That our thoughts are always
running around,
floating around. You know, every split second, there's like a 100,000 thoughts in a second. And I mean, who would see that as a problem until they had a moment of stillness? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think you can say where some people find it a problem is when they're trying to fall asleep. I think a lot of people suffer insomnia because they can't still their mind.
Or they suffer from, say, depression, and they can't get themselves out of it. Or they're obsessed with something.
That's when it comes over and takes over the mind.
Well, sometimes people are just overwhelmed by it.
Overwhelmed.
Like, there's just so much going on. Yeah. They can't process everything.
Yep.
That happens a lot now, actually.
Yeah.
I think, yeah. So then the next section, the next section is, this is when we talk about the benefits of dhyana. So this is when we mentioned before about the happiness that dhyana brings. So this is, dhyana is the treasury for the retaining of wisdom, which we just talked about, the still room, and the field of merit for qualities which are worthy. Dhyana serves as the waters which are pure, is able to wash away the dust of the desires. Dhyana is the armor made of vajra, say like diamond. It's able to ward off the arrows of affliction. So yeah, that's what we were saying, that's the fun, it's not getting stressed out, right? Although one's not yet reached nirvana without residue, a share in nirvana nonetheless has been attained. Once it sees in gaining the Vajra Samadhi, smashing then and shattering the mountain of the fetters, one attains the power of the six super knowledges and is able to deliver a number of people beyond count.
That's right. This answered your question.
Yeah. You smash through all your fetters and delusion, then you can help a lot of people. Dust raised by tumult may obscure the sky and sun, yet a heavy rain may soak it all away. The winds of ideation and deliberation scour the mind. Nonetheless, the unabsorbent able to extinguish them. I really like that. That metaphor is very good.
Their metaphors and imageries are wonderful. So
yeah. Rich. We just had a rainstorm here.
Yeah.
So all the dust is... quiets down. So those are the benefits of dhyana meditation. So if you can make dhyana meditation what you think is fun, well, you can cultivate this path and find a lot of good things behind it.
Plus you get a Vajra armor.
So. A Vajra armor. Yeah, that's
who like doesn't want a Vajra armor?
So using the video game analogy, you got the special Vajra armor. And you're impenetrable to arrows of affliction. So yeah. You can go into the battle of the mind without getting injured. So, I'll make the comment now, which was I had another thought in terms of making Dharma fun, although I haven't really thought how to do it yet, is that if you really think about it, cultivation, it's kind of like a game if you frame it. So if you actually, you can do a video game, but like any game, like a sports or something, the precepts like the rules of the game, right? And then dhyana concentration or meditation is like the skill you're developing in the game. So if I'm like playing a video game, I'm getting better and better at the game, or I'm playing basketball, I'm getting better and better at basketball. So that's the skill I'm getting game. The wisdom is complete mastery. When you understand the game just through and through, you have insights into how to play it, you just know exactly what to do, you have that kind of insight. Cultivation is just like that in many ways. But rather than leading you to a kind of afflicted state, like for instance, I remember playing a lot of video games. At the end of the process of playing, let's say, 5 hours of video games straight, the mind is actually really agitated and wired. And you still want to play, but you don't physically, you just can't really take it anymore. You just say, I got to do it. And I know people actually, I think I've read in the newspaper that people actually die playing games.
Sometimes.
In Asia.
Once in a while.
Yeah. You just stop everything, just play and
dying. As you're saying this, I was just having a thought. If you make meditation as a video game, it would be really, really boring.
Yeah.
But someone actually did as an experiment or something. Someone designed a video game where I think if you start the game, it showed a monk sitting down. And the moment you touch any of the controls, the game ends.
What a game.
Yeah. And I think you can Google it. This was a few months ago.
A new game.
So the point of the game is just to sit there and not do anything. Yeah.
So was it popular again?
What?
Was it popular?
No, it was just an experiment. So a lot of people were very surprised. They're like, what's going on? So they try to touch a button, game ends.
Game ends.
Yeah, then you start all over again. So the whole point is, you play the game by not playing.
But actually, in terms of moving the mind over to that, I think you can see cultivation as a game if you have that in your mindset of what you use to spend a lot of time in. Like for instance, I would say I spent a lot of time playing video games.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I took all that time and played basketball, which were all games. So then you could move that all over to, you know, cultivation.
Not to belabor this point, I think the only thing about it, I realize this is getting a little bit kind of Buddhist geeky, I apologize to everybody, but that I think in a lot of cases, these things are done for self-gratification. It's almost really interesting how Nagarjuna actually kind of recontextualizes. I mean, he emphasizes that this is not for your own gain. Mm. It's to benefit other people.
Yeah. That's a good point.
So it's like saying, you know, you can play a computer, you can play a game, you can play, and everyone will benefit from it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's even better.
Even better.
as a meaningful gain.
Instead of your mother thinking, oh, you stupid, like, what are you doing with your time? To be happy!
Yeah.
For video games, I don't think so. I'm playing this to benefit people, mom.
Oh, what can we have with lollipop? I remember people saying, well, this is good for developing strategy and finger eye coordination skills.
I have a confession. I actually tried that on my mom
before
I came to CDTB as a lay person. And she was saying, you shouldn't be playing all those video games where you know, the first person shooters. When you came, I said, I'm killing all my afflictions. And she said, yeah, right. She didn't buy that.
Okay, so the next one, the section was actually goes into how you achieve dhyana paramita, which I think is very useful because he's actually very specific and goes in great depth explaining how you cultivate dhyana. And so he talks about first we have to renounce the five classes of phenomena, which are the five sense objects, eliminates the five hindrances, and adopt the five practices. So here he actually basically goes into each section in a lot of depth. So he says, what is meant by renouncing the five phenomena? This means one should condemn the five desires. How pitiful. Beings are constantly afflicted by the five desires, and yet they still continue to seek after them endlessly. Okay, this is pretty strong. As for these five desires, one obtains them, and they become more severe. This is just as when one uses a fire to cauterize an itch. I don't know if people have seen that before. You know what that means?
Cauterize? I think it is an overkill, right?
I think it uses it. Okay, people correct me if I'm wrong. I believe that's what lepers do.
Oh.
Lepers. Lepers, they have all these sores on their body and really itchy. So what they do is the way they feel like it's freeing them is they actually like put fire, they burn it. And then it gives them some relief from the itch.
I think this is a medical practice that like to burn your skin to heal a wound.
Mm.
But then I think the analogy
to stop
here
bleeding.
Is,
if you bleed,
right, if you burn something,
you cauterize. Yeah, but
I think that the analogy is that normally you wouldn't do that for an itch.
Yeah.
So overdoing it is
overdoing.
To actually use this medical practice of burning your skin for the itch, which really only needs a little bit of, you know, something put on the skin.
Overkill. Yeah, but I think that at least one of the stories I was hearing was that for people with leprosy, they actually they try to get rid of the itch through burning it, and then ends up becoming way worse because the body, you know, it develops all these other problems, but they get a little bit of satisfaction and relief from it by doing that.
Actually, itchiness is the worst skin. Itchiness is worse than pain. Apparently, a doctor told me once that people problems of itching is the worst thing that can happen to a person. That affects the mind. I mean, the suffering they have to go through from itchiness compared to other kinds of maladies.
So pursuing the five desires is a useless endeavor compared to a dog's gnawing away at a bone. Pursuing the five desires increases disputation, just as when birds fight with each other over carrion. The five desires burn people in the same way as happens when carrying a torch into an opposing wind. So that's not so good and smart. The five desires harms a person just as when one steps on a poisonous snake. You've heard that one. The five desires are insubstantial, like something obtained in a dream. Satisfaction from the five desires is short-lived and is as if borrowed for just an instant. Worldly people deluded the lust for and attached to the five desires, not forsaking them even unto death. On account of them, in later lives they undergo immeasurable suffering. This is analogous to a stupid person greedily attached to a type of fine fruit who climbs up a tree and feasts upon them, but cannot bring himself to descend in time. Someone then chops down the tree, causing the tree to tilt over, whereupon he falls. His body and head are mingled, and then he dies an agonizing death. Ooh. Moreover, these five desires, when attained, are blissful only for a moment. When lost, there is great suffering. This is compared with when a person licks away at a honey-smeared blade. In his greed for the sweetness, is unaware of injuring his tongue. The rituals involved in pursuing the five desires are held in common with animals. One who is wise is well aware of this, and thus is naturally able to distance himself from them. So it goes into great depth about sensual desire, given the time. You can read that in your own time. This is a very interesting verse about how sensual desire is not beneficial.
Do we talk about the five desires? Like, are they associated with the five senses, or is it actually different categories of desires?
This one is talking about the five sense objects.
I see, okay.
So, but there's a section on sensual desires, which are now, if I want to talk about, just to go over, is the five hindrances.
Okay.
So the first one, the five hindrances, is actually sensual desire, actually. So connected to the previous one. And basically it says how sensual desire, again, is not valuable. And the other ones, actually, we can go over real quick, which I didn't print out, but is actually, I think this is actually one of the best explanations I've read about each of these, why each of these things are you could say.
I think given the harmful time left, maybe we can talk about the last page, the benefits of eliminating them.
Yeah. I just want to read what they are.
Okay.
Real quick. Chapter heading. So the first one's sensual desire. I think the second one's ill will. The third one is lethargy and sleepiness. The fourth one is excitedness and regretfulness. And the fifth one is doubtfulness. So for instance, actually, just as a pointer, for instance, I thought the regretfulness was really useful because he actually says after you do something wrong, you shouldn't go and dwell on it. You don't dwell on mistakes. This is why bother dwelling on mistakes. So it was really interesting. He's really specific on how to not be regretful, but he says you still realize you made a mistake. So anyway, so that's that section. Okay, so he then talks about the benefits of eliminating these five hindrances. So what happens if we're not, caught by sensual desire, doubt, etc.? Does anybody else want to read? I realize I've been reading the whole time. You want to read?
Okay. So the benefits of eliminating the five hindrances or the five similes. Nagarjuna says, when one gets rid of these five hindrances, it is analogous to paying off a debt and being released from it, like gaining a cure for a serious disease, or like leaving behind a place of famine and reaching a country of abundance, or like getting out of prison. It's like being rescued from the midst of evil bandits so that one is peaceful, secure, and free of calamity. It is just like this for the practitioner. When he gets rid of the five hindrances, his mind becomes peaceful, secure, pure, and blissful.
And I actually recently listened to a Dharma talk by Ajahn Pasana, and he actually related each of these to the hindrance. So he said, when we're free of sensual desire, it is just like paying off a debt. You're free of debt.
Yeah.
And then he said the second one, you're free of ill will. It's like a cure of a serious disease. Ill will kind of takes over the mind, and you're just always, and so you're free of it. Right. And then he says the next one, regretfulness and excitedness is like leaving behind a place of famine and reaching a country of abundance.
I just want to say that for normal people who go about everyday lives, it's really difficult to see why the normal pleasures of life can be seen as harmful. And if you have that view, then all this doesn't make sense. Why should I abandon the pleasures of life? I don't want to be a monk. Why should I abandon the pleasures of life? But there's a different way of saying this, which is, first of all, we already mentioned that the bliss of dhyana far surpasses any worldly pleasure that is to offer. No matter how pleasurable something can be, dhyana bliss surpasses that. And secondly, it is, for example, say if you like food or you like there's something that excites you and you happen to stumble across the best kept secret in the world, that you come across the best restaurant in the world that's stuck behind this little, on a little street corner, and the food is just so amazing that you can't help but want to share with all your friends. It's so amazing. It's like, oh, they make the best sandwiches or the best cake, and you just want to bring all your friends and want them to be able to share in this amazing little restaurant. Or you find the place that makes the best dresses and it's not expensive, you know, or
not expensive.
Or a place that, depending on what you really like, or a place that makes bespoke or handmade watches that are affordable, you know, and you have and you are a watch collector and you want everyone to be able to share in this. So this is the Bodhisattva's motivation. They discover something that is so great that they just want everyone to share in it. So for someone who hasn't been, who knows how, say, how nice sandwiches could be, when you tell them about this place, they're like, nah, it's okay, you know. We'll go tomorrow. We don't have to go right now. Why are you so excited? But the moment they go and they eat it for themselves, wow, you're right. You know, I never knew sandwiches could be that fantastic. And then they want to get themselves, their other friends, to come. So that's the Bodhisattva's motivation. They discover something that's beyond what normal people can enjoy, and they want to share it. And that's why they say you have to leave certain things behind, but what's waiting for you on the other side is something even better. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A much better sandwich.
And when you get there, you will want to share it with other people, trust me.
Yeah, so I think the other area that Jason could take a quick look at, and that people can chime in with those questions or other thoughts, is the practicing the five dharmas. So I won't go into detail, but I'll just read what they are. There's five. It's zeal, chanda, vigor, virya, mindfulness, smriti, discerning knowledge, samprajnana, single-mindedness, citta ekagra. I don't know if I said those right. I probably can say them correctly. But basically, zeal refers to desire to escape from desires of the desire realm and gain the realization of the first dhyana. So you have this kind of
motivation.
Yeah, that'd be a good way to put it. Vigor refers to abetting the home life. So you don't have all the home. But observing the virtue precepts, maintaining exclusively focus and not lax in the beginning of the night, the end of the night, being measured in eating, and focus the mind in a way which is not allowed to run off, become scattered. Mindfulness is being mindful of the bliss of the first dhyana, being aware of the desire realm is impure, deceptive, and worthy of being seen as base, whereas the first dhyana is honorable, to be esteemed, and worthy of being seen as noble. Discerning knowledge refers to contemplating, investing, and taking the measure of the bliss of the desire realm as compared with the bliss of the first dhyana, thus realizing that then their relative importance and benefits. So as Jinghaju just talked about, you find the secret restaurant.
Yeah.
And you know, wow, this secret restaurant is way better than all the other restaurants. Single-mindedness refers to constantly anchoring the mind in midst of specific objective conditions while not allowing it to split off and become scattered. And that's those explanations of those particular five. So you practice these five, and you let go of the other, you could say, 10. And then you're on your way to dhyana, concentration. So there's actually a lot of depth. Nagarjuna then goes into great depth into like actual what the first dhyana is like, second dhyana is like, third dhyana is like, how you have like the right access knowledge or wisdom, I guess you call it. So since I don't have those states, I have to say, yeah. I didn't really talk about that.
I don't know how much time we have. I guess that's was going to be one of my other questions. It's not. It's my personal question, or maybe something that would be interesting to kind of address. Is, you know, I obviously haven't experienced first dhyana, like, you know, different stages of dhyana. But then, can we experience dhyana bliss even though we're just kind of doing regular meditation in my own deluded, like, you know, meditation? And is that still really
good?
Does that still apply? All the things that we talked about,
I think most of it, I think it all applies, but we're just like We're just at a very preliminary stage. I mean, we can still see that dhyana is far superior and all other things, we just don't have a first-hand experience with it. We can feel a little bit more peaceful.
Right. Yeah, and it's also we don't know what there have been instances where because people have cultivated well before and they have the good roots, and when they start to meditate, they can't enter dhyana.
Yeah.
Because of their past good roots. But there are different stages of dhyana. The first dhyana is what's mentioned here. But before that, for normal meditators, there are times when you enter amazing moments of clarity, or you feel, how would I say, you feel a sense of well-being and comfort that makes you feel like you can just sit there and not having to move or your mind move and be able to just sit there for hours. And that's all attainable without entering dhyana concentration. But I think the biggest benefits are when you sit, the clarity of mind that you get gives you the ability to understand how your own mind works in relation to the conditions around you. And then you begin to build, how would I say, solidity inside you that start getting stronger and stronger. Then you get a kind of independence and happiness that does not depend on your external conditions.
Yeah, especially since I think for this class a lot of people have done a session or are practicing, and they're probably here in this class and online because they have seen or experienced something like just a little bit of that stillness and that peace.
Yeah, and the key is to just have a practice that's regular, that's ongoing all the time. If you do it, I think it's just like training for anything, like sports or studying. If you do it once and you let it go, and you come back and you let it go again, or you do it for a week and let it go, I don't think you're gonna see much benefit. But if you do it every day and keep on doing it every day, before you realize it. Yeah.
Yeah. Are there any questions online? Or thoughts online? Is there any questions on dhyana? Questions about how to make the Dharma fun in general? You can make dhyana fun for you?
I think it's just like a kind of like what Doug said. It's just your background. It just affects your mind and how you interact with people. Is this fresher,
when you cultivate, you mean?
When you cultivate, it's more spontaneous, and that in itself is, if it's not so kind of solidified, that it's more new, all your interactions are new every time. That's, for me, that's just pretty cool. I mean, it's fun, it's great. So,
and you find that the things that used to bug you don't bug you anymore,
right?
And that's very refreshing to have.
Do you have any ideas, Veda?
In
terms of having fun in the Dharma or dhyana? Any final thoughts?
Oh, you're asking me for
final thoughts. Seeing if there are any thoughts.
I think we should turn the camera on you.
See, his face is very...
You have a specific question that I can...
Well, you mentioned in the beginning, for instance, right. You thought about Dharma being fun and how to do that. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
In your interview, on how to make Dharma fun.
How to make Dharma fun.
How to make Dharma fun. Yes, I mean, I think one aspect is indeed community.
Mm.
And I think there's a lot to be, just having good people around. And have a good sense of interaction.
So I just thought something. Actually, I think one major thing is learning new things is really fun for a lot of people.
Yeah, things they couldn't see by themselves.
If you didn't, if there was a, if you they're learning new things in a way that makes sense, that's actually really fun.
Mm-hmm.
I think most young people, I was just here with all these little kids, like sixth graders. My goodness, right. They got so many much energy to like want to learn stuff and do stuff. I think at some point, like maybe ninth or 10th grade, for a lot of kids that wish to learn shuts down. I think, I don't know, it changes. I was wow, it was so raw with that group of kids. But I can see that at a certain time, maybe it's because people are so driven to want to get a college, go to college or something, that wish to just learn for the sake of learning and exploring something, it somehow gets sidetracked into productivity or something. I don't know.
So you learn for something else.
Yeah, you learn for something else. But that purity of like wanting to learn, if you can maintain that, I think actually there's a lot of potential there.
Mm-hmm.
That Dharma is really deep. You can always be learning new stuff forever.
Right. And I think perhaps another thing is creativity.
Mm.
A lot of people have a lot of joy in making things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I used to actually, when I was a teenager, especially in the sort of earlier years, I was already like painting and music. But there's a lot of, I mean, I think people can have a lot of fun trying to engage in a Dharma in a sort of artistic way.
Mm. Yep. Okay, that's a good idea.
Mm. So Tom asked, what makes studying a Dharma fun for you? Like, we kind of addressed that a little bit, right?
Okay, what people can probably share and chime in what they think. If mm-hmm. I were to, off the top of my head, why I find studying the Dharma really fun is because it's, well, I think one thing is like, I like to learn, and so I always feel like I'm learning something I didn't know before. I get it's especially when it's like touching something like the Nagarjuna Bodhisattva or the sutras, it feels like something that is very profound, that's much greater than my own mind, that's not coming from just a conscious mind. Like, wow, there's something meaningful here. So I think for me, I have to say, my fun is often attached to meaning, at least now. I think before I learned the Dharma, I didn't have that sense so much. So like, you know, I just watch movies and just do whatever, play video games. But I think right now, I wouldn't find those so fun because they don't hold any meaning. Mm. Or actually, they almost feel like I'm going the wrong way. So it's like, why am I doing this? You know, I can have a sense of it on the airplane flying. The last time I was going to Taiwan, all the movie screens are like all over. It's like, whoa. You know, on the plane now, it's kind of scary. Whenever I walk these, the bathroom, walk back, everybody's a little cubicle, there's a little screen in front.
Like, now everybody's got smart devices. So yeah. It's better.
So it's like it reminds me kind of the Matrix.
Yeah.
Have a little screen in front of us.
Actually, I think what's fun is not having to depend on fun.
Yeah,
that's really fun. I find that the more I understand the Dharma, it seems that the more independent you are, the more well-being you are, the more constant your state of mind. That means you're always cool, you're always calm, you don't, there's no need for fun anymore. And that's really fun. You know what I mean? When you have no need for fun, it's like, how would I say it? It's like patience. If you're trying to be patient, you still need to have patience. But once you overcome whatever affliction that caused you to want to have patience, and you have mastery over that, you don't need patience anymore, right? So to me, if you understand, the more you understand about the Dharma, the less you need to rely on fun to have fun. So you're still having fun, but you don't have to depend on fun, and everything's fun.
The perfection
Does that make
of
sense?
Fun. Yeah.
Perfection of fun, if you want
perfection
to call it that. Yeah. I don't know how to articulate it better. I'm really sorry, but I think you become independent of fun, but you are still having fun. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I would say you would do a lot of things in the monastery. If I was a kid growing up, I would think it's not fun at all, for sure.
Yeah.
And even in situations still, which I think if I were to have my without Dharma method, I will find not being very fun at all. But since I have a Dharma method, I can kind of keep my mind doing some Dharma thing. Mm. So I don't get pulled into a negative thinking, this is not fun.
Yeah. Honestly, I have more fun as a monk right now than I ever had when I was a layperson. And I had a very nice, interesting life as a layperson. So, yeah.
Yeah. So. fun in the
Any
Dharma.
More questions?
Okay.
I think one. I also think I mentioned it before, but I think one other part of fun in the Dharma is like actually sharing and sort of. I can't say I teach the Dharma, but you know, whenever you can share the Dharma,
share with other people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or just more mundane, be there for others. Like to actually have a dharmic foundation, you can actually, like Jason sort of said, you have a sort of groundedness from where you can interact with others.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the Dharma is fine, that's for sure.
Yeah. Okay, that's our conclusion. Okay.
If anyone's not having fun at Dharma, come see us. Or rather, Peter and Jason.
Okay. Good evening. Right.
Okay. So
thanks for joining online.
Next week.
Hope you had fun. Right. Next week, I think it's isn't karma just fate? I think that's the topic. Isn't karma just fate?
With Douglas Power or Doug Powers.
With Doug Powers. So, yeah. Okay.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
See you.
Bye-bye.
Good night.